Welcome, and thank you all for coming. I'm Glenda Manzi. I serve as a board member on the Boston Book Festival. So we depend on donations, and in the middle of your program is an envelope. If you would like to donate, we would greatly appreciate it, because as you know, this whole event for 10 years now is free. Oh, sorry. I'm asking for money. Okay. Now, so inside of your program is an envelope, and you can make a donation. Or you can go over in front of Trinity Church to our pavilion, and for $50, you will get a Boston Book Festival anniversary tote bag. For $150, you'll get the tote bag filled with an author's book, a BBF umbrella. I want to thank you in advance for thinking about donating to us. And now I would like to welcome the moderator for this session. Rebecca Henderson is a Harvard Business School professor. She is an economist, and she is now working on a book called Reimagining Capitalism. So, Rebecca, thank you. As you will see, one of our panelists is not here yet, but we're hoping to welcome him soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, particularly because I have two fabulous speakers, and we're in hopes of having three. So let me introduce my two speakers. To my left is Bob Kuttner, who's a professor at Brandeis, and has just finished a book called Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? The book was out in April. We're very much hoping the answer is yes, but Bob will tell us more. And just beyond him is Dambisa Moyo, who is an extraordinarily well-known financial journalist, sits on the board of a number of Fortune 100 companies, and has just finished a book called The Edge of Chaos.
That's right.
Again, we're hoping you're wrong.
But, the edge, not in chaos.
So in chaos. Okay. So let's begin. I had the great good fortune of reading all three books for this panel. Yasha Munk, who I hope will join us, has written a book called The People Versus Democracy. And what's fascinating about these books is that they all posit that we're in a difficult and potentially dangerous time. But they have a different diagnosis of what's gone wrong and why. So my first question to the panelists, do either of you have a strong desire to go first? Thank you,
Gentlemen Bob. First.
My first question to the panelists is, what's got wrong and why?
Thank you so much. I've never given a talk about the economy in church before, and when you're talking about how to reconcile capitalism with democracy, prayer might be indicated, so it seems to be a good place. Democracy and capitalism, contrary to the Friedmans, Milton and Tom, are like combining oil and water. If you think about it, one person, one vote, $1, one vote, very different first principles. And yet there was a remarkable period in the history of capitalism and in the history of democracy that ran from about 1933 to the mid-70s in the United States, that ran from 1944 until the late 70s in Europe, where we pulled off that trick. And it was a kind of a harmonic convergence that made that possible. Capitalism defined as let markets do their thing and don't interfere with them too much, disgraced itself in 1929. It usefully disgraced the Republican Party as the sponsor of that view of capitalism. And we got very lucky in that we got Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. If you think about it, in January 1933, Roosevelt is assembling his cabinet in Washington. Very same month, Hitler is assembling his cabinet in Berlin, which tells you that when ordinary people are displaced and aggrieved, that grievance can go far right, it can go democratic left, it can go far left. And so we entered an era in which capitalism was housebroken in a way that made it socially bearable without completely undermining its entrepreneurial zeal. And there followed a period in the United States where the economy both grew at record rates and grew more equal at record rates. The bottom 20% in the post-war boom actually gained income at a faster rate than the top 20%. This did not just happen. It was the result of politics. It was the result of a particular architecture that some people call managed capitalism. And that went off the rails beginning in the 1970s for reasons that we can talk about in the discussion. Now, if you think this was in any way inevitable, you may dimly remember what almost happened in February of 1933. Roosevelt is in his open car giving a speech in Miami. An anarchist by the name of Giuseppe Zangara comes within a few feet of the president-elect, fires six shots, missed. If he'd hit Roosevelt, anybody remember who the president would have been? Cactus Jack Garner, a racist from Texas who is remembered for one saying. He once said, the vice presidency is not worth a bucket of warm spit, except he didn't say spit. They cleaned it up to put it in a family newspaper. So this was a harmonic convergence that involved a fair amount of luck. And in the 1970s, after we had a difficult decade, the capitalists regained their usual power in a capitalist economy. And 40 years later, after ordinary people have suffered insecurity, after the democratic state has lost a lot of legitimacy, we get Trump. It was only a matter of time. Trump's election may have had elements of accident, but this was an accident waiting to happen because both parties in the United States lost sight of the need to harness capitalism in the broad public interest. Now, the one last thought, and I know I'm out of time. The democratic capitalism of the Roosevelt era was far from perfect. It was a bargain with racists. Black people were excluded. Immigration was restricted. Women were not full members. That took another 20 years. And one of the things I want to get into later is the relationship between identity politics and political economy. Because in order to work our way out of this, and I am an optimist, I think the United States is the one country in the West where a Rooseveltian left could come back to power. But we got to be really, really careful of these toxic identity issues that Trump is so good at exploiting. So let us pray that the Democrats do not do their usual circular firing squad and take advantage of the moment and take back our democracy.
Thanks, Bob. Tumbizo, what's wrong and why?
Well, I want to assure you that there's going to be a lot of debate this afternoon because I largely disagree with the sentiment that Bob has just suggested. And, you know, listening to you, I'm appreciating some of the subtleties of your argument, got me thinking, gosh, you know it's bad when an African has to come to the United States to argue for capitalism. But it sounds like that's my job here. And I have to say, it is counterintuitive to the book that I published in April, Edge of Chaos. And maybe I'll just give a bit of context in what I was arguing in that book and then talk a little bit more generally about why we do need to fight for capitalism, but a capitalism that actually works in an effective way, which I'm very optimistic that we can do that. We can put a man on the moon. I think we can solve many of the problems that the world is facing today. My book of Edge of Chaos is split into two parts. And it's important to understand that I actually am an economist. My PhD is in economics, and I am enamored and seduced by all issues economics. However, I'm also a frustrated economist because many of the issues that I believe are critically important that the world is facing today are long-term, deeply entrenched structural problems that unfortunately are mismatched with the short-termism that's embedded in both political and business leadership. Let me just quickly highlight six of those economic headwinds, and I'll just list them, and then we can talk about them some more during the Q&A. In no particular order, technology and the risk of a jobless underclass. There are many studies coming out now. McKinsey, Rebecca will know very well, has put out a study estimating that 800 million people around the world are at threat of losing their jobs from automation. A few years ago, a report from Oxford University, St. Martin's School, estimated that 47% of jobs in the United States would be gone by 2030. They've come back a little bit in terms of their estimates, but these were quite stark numbers. But it's not just about the risk of technology and what that might mean for joblessness and what will people be doing is obviously one of the key questions that policymakers have to address. There's also the rise of AI, quantum computing, and many of you, I'm sure, in this room will have seen that there's a real concern that China may actually be taking a lead in many of these areas. So technology and what actually happens to society is a key issue facing public policy. Second issue is demographics. The quality and the quantity of the world's population, particularly the workforce, is changing dramatically. It took us about 40 years to go from 3 billion, from 3 billion to where we are today, to nearly 8 billion people. And according to the United Nations, the world's population will continue to grow at a rapid clip until 2100, when we'll be 11 billion people on the planet. 40% of the world's population will be from my home continent of Africa. This is a place which continues to be characterized as being a place of poverty, war, disease, and corruption. And if you live in Europe, which I'm sure many of you do not, you will be familiar with the disorderly migration and what the implications of that might be. So demographics, huge. Places like India are adding 1 million people a month to their population. This is a massive, massive challenge for the world. But also, the quality of the workforce is deteriorating, precisely at the time where we're seeing considerable need for higher technology and better skills to satiate demand from many of corporations. According to the OECD, which is a club of wealthy countries, the United States, for the first time in the history of this country, will see that this generation of Americans will be less educated than the preceding generation. The consequences, not just for the United States, but for the world in its entirety, are enormous. The world relies on the United States to deliver R&D, innovation, to help solve some of the world's most intractable, seemingly intractable challenges that we face, whether it's healthcare, disease, environment, etc. Third issue, income inequality. When I did my doctorate, and actually I went to the Kennedy School to do my master's about 20 years ago, nobody talked about income inequality. And yet today it is absolutely in the top three policy agenda items. Bob is saying he did speak about it. Well, guess what? It wasn't on the policy agenda. There was a very deeply held belief that actually if we had social mobility and if we actually invested in education, we would have a situation where people would be able to get better jobs and improve their livelihoods. That has not happened. The underinvestment in education, and this is not on a dollar basis, this is just poor quality outcomes in education, is again reflected in some of the statistics coming out of the OECD with PISA studies, which show that the United States, Britain, and many leading countries that used to be in the top three best-ranked countries in these subjects is now hovering at the bottom. The other issues are very familiar in this room, issues of natural resource scarcity and climate change. The amount of debt, the sheer amount of debt that the world is carrying today. In this country, every class of debt, government debt, household debt, credit card debt, student loan debt, auto loan debt, corporate debt, is at record levels, each class over $1 trillion. What are we going to do in a time when interest rates are rising? And then the final point I'd just make is the issue of productivity, which we were talking about earlier, a key engine for economic success. This is something that has stalled in the past 10 years. So in a nutshell, we're facing all these deeply, deeply structural problems at particularly a particular time when the public policy agenda, but particularly politics, has become much more short-term, creating the schism between these long-term economic challenges and the short-term and embedded in politics. And that, to me, is the fundamental problem that we need to address.
So that was pretty sobering. But I'm tempted to say, wait, it gets worse. So I want to move to solutions pretty soon. Yes. But can I ask just a couple of follow-up questions? So, Bob, you talked about basically a capitalism out of control. And in your book, you talk about the dangers of a global capitalism and the nation state not being able to control global capital flows and the race to the bottom. And Dombisa, you talk about these major headwinds that we face. Both of those seem reasonable, but there seem to be at least a couple of other things going on, right? Don't we have a major breakdown in liberal democracy? And the number of people who think that a democracy is not the right way to run the society has declined. I was particularly struck by a chart that suggested that among 18 to 24-year-olds, 24% say military rule would be fine, and this is in the U.S. And the perception of gridlock, a sort of turning to strong men, isn't that another part of our moment? Dumbisa, you want to go first?
Yeah, so there is an array of challenges and issues with the political system, the liberal democratic system. I think both Bob and I would have outlined these arguments in our books, but in terms of where I see it, we know that voter participation has plummeted. One of the most corrosive things about the American style of liberal democracy is that money has seeped into the political process. This is not as acute as we see in other places where democracy is the political order. In places like Scandinavia, is nowhere near corrosive as it is here. You probably are aware that just 158 American families were responsible for 50% of political contributions in this country in 2016. I mean, those type of statistics suggest to me that there's a much more corrosive problem from money. But the trust statistics, issues from Freedom House in terms of just the decline in freedom, yes, it is incredibly corrosive, but I strongly believe that a lot of that has to do with the short-termism that's embedded in the political process. The problems that we face are long-term. We want governments that are focused on long-term agendas, not trying to seduce us as voters in today's election, knowing fully well that the consequences longer term are going to be enormous for future generations. And to me, that's that trade-off that I think has been missing in this country. And I think maybe the last point I would say is that it's very tempting to criticize capitalism. But I can assure you, as somebody who spent the bulk of my life living in a society which was not democratic and not capitalist, be careful what you wish for, because the ability to reverse into a situation which is democratic and has at least the tenets of capitalism in place is very difficult. And I think what we should be focusing on is trying to make capitalism and democracy work better rather than jettison the whole system.
Thank you. Bob?
If you were to reduce my book to one sentence, and this is not an original thought with me, the great guru of this view, who everybody should read if you haven't, is a man named Karl Polanyi. But the basic point is, when capitalism runs amok and deprives ordinary people of their economic livelihood, people tend to turn to dictators. And that's what happened in the 20s and 30s because of the failure to have a recovery program after World War II and the attempt to resurrect laissez-faire capitalism, World War I, and the attempt to resurrect laissez-faire capitalism. And it's what's happened in our own day as all of the gains have gone to the top. This is not about inequality as an abstraction. It's about my life and the economic prospects of my children going down the drain, and both political parties in the United States being enablers of that. Now, anybody who thinks that capitalism can regulate itself or right itself need only read history. Read about what happened in the 20s and what happened in 1929. Read about the deregulation of finance that undid the social contract that obtained beginning with the New Deal, and how that led directly to the economic collapse of 2008, which cost the world economy, depending on what you count, between $10 and $19 trillion, which wiped out all of the putative efficiencies of deregulation. The only way you can harness capitalism in the broad public interest is by having a democracy with countervailing institutions strong enough to prevent capitalism in the raw from acting on its most unsavory tendencies. We had that for a 40-year period. We lost it, and that was the road to Trumpism. Now, these are not technical problems. This is not primarily about automation.
Are you transitioning to solutions?
Yes. I am transitioning directly to solutions. This is not about automation. It's not about technology. It's not about productivity. In 1939, the unemployment rate was stuck at around 14%. A lot of economists of that era said, well, it's automation. Machines are replacing humans. Along came the World War II buildup, and unemployment disappeared. This is about politics. The solutions are political. It came off the rails because the political guardrails around capitalism were defeated, and we need to put them back together again. and that's a political enterprise. And I want to be very clear about this. You know, I give this talk, and some Marxist will invariably ask a question and say, well, why would you want to resurrect managed capitalism? Why not have socialism? Well, socialism has all kinds of its own problems. So I think the entrepreneurial impulse is a very good impulse, but capitalism out of control destroys democracy and destroys the ability of democracy to regulate capitalism in a broad public interest. And that's a political enterprise. It's not a technical enterprise. And all of the talk about automation, productivity, education, I think deflects us from realizing that it's a political enterprise. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the golden age of American capitalism, the average American had not gone to college, and many people in the blue-collar middle class had not graduated from high school. But people could earn a decent living because we had strong trade unions, we had government intervening in the economy, and so we're looking in the wrong places if we try to solve a political problem with technical solutions.
Don't be so. Well, not to put you on the spot, but what's your view of where we need to look for solutions?
So we obviously have some overlap, and I'm not entirely sure if Bob is sort of watering down what I thought his original argument was, which is I thought I perhaps misunderstood. I thought you were essentially suggesting that capitalism is so corrosive that we should be moving away from it. But it sounds like you're suggesting we should have more of a managed capitalism, which would be interesting to hear a little bit more of what you suggest by that. I think I'd be hard-pressed to find people that I know who would say, actually, we like the purest form of capitalism, one that has been seen as being quite rapacious, not only in terms of the environment, but also in terms of corruption, creating sort of clubs, essentially, that govern the world in terms of capital. And you're absolutely right that the gains from globalization, for example, have accrued largely to people who hold capital and not to the labor force. Real wages have been down, et cetera. We know those arguments. And I also agree with you that this is a political problem. I mentioned to you in my opening remarks that I'm a frustrated economist, because anything that economists come up with, you know, whether you're on the left or on the right, tends to be usurped by political intervention. So, but with the frame that our politicians are far too short-term, and by the way, are rationally doing what they do. They're not crazy, they're not dumb. They're absolutely working within the confines of the democratic process, and they know that if they want to win a seat, they have to pander to today's voters. They recognize that, and so there has to be something that has to be done to move the lens of politicians out of this short-term, this myopia, into much more long-term thinking. My book offers 10 solutions. I'm not going to be able to go through all 10. 6 of them are targeting politicians. The balance, 4 of them, are targeting voters, because I think we also take this sort of victim view and say, well, somebody else has to solve this. Well, no, we are voters. We have an ability to do something as well. But I think just to give you a little bit of flavor in terms of the solutions that I propose, and I want to assure you that I didn't just cook them up in my kitchen. These are solutions and actually enhancements to democracy that are already in place in many other countries around the world, and they seem to work quite effectively. And I also wrote this book with the recognition that the United States in particular, which in many respects remains the vanguard of liberal democracy, has an ability to innovate, has an ability to change. You know, this is something that I fear that seems to be missing in this country. As somebody from out of this country, we've always been told that America innovates. If they see something wrong, they change, whether it's women's suffrage or civil rights. And so hopefully we can get a groundswell to change this. But if I could just offer 2 specific examples. So in terms of politicians, I do suggest that we look at extending political terms. This idea of having elections every 2 years is absurd as far as I'm concerned. It's not helpful because it does encourage politicians to behave in the short term. Countries around the world, your next door neighbor to the south, Mexico, but other countries across Europe have longer terms. You could argue, and I do in the book, that you may want to match those terms with long-term cycles, business cycles. You could have at least 6 years. And you can have a system where the politicians are not allowed to run again. So there are things you can do in that respect. Another one which is potentially controversial, another proposal potentially controversial in this country, but once again seems to be working really well elsewhere, is that you should pay politicians more money, but force them to justify their compensation. In Singapore, politicians are paid 30 to 40% bonuses at the end of every year, if they show that long-term outcomes, whether it's healthcare or infrastructure, actually are improving on a year-to-year basis. But more than that, if they find out in years to come that actually politicians were just rubbing the numbers and were up to no good and actually didn't deliver, they have an ability to claw back on compensation. Many of us who work in the private sector are already subjected to these types of terms. And it may seem trivial, but I think those types of innovations are things we need to think about. And I don't see why there's not much more campaign for that kind of thinking.
So, Bob, could I build on Dombisa's suggestions? She's very much focused on changing the sort of structure of the electoral system, trying to persuade all politicians to be more longer-term focused and more electors, more citizens to be more longer-term focused. You have a very different view of what the solution might look like. Can you explain that in a little bit of depth, just a little, because I do want to get to the how do we actually get there from here question. But
yes, I don't think the problem is that politicians pander to voters in the short term. I think the problem is that politicians pander to banks and corporations in the long term, and banks and corporations have invested a huge amount of money in politics, and that's how most of the really toxic deregulation happened under Bill Clinton. They managed to suborn both parties. Now, if you think about what is really destroying American democracy today, it's less the long-term structural aspects than it is the fact that President Trump has no respect whatsoever for democratic norms. I mean, if you look at extending terms of office, if Trump and Orban and Kaczynski and Erdogan had their way, they'd extend their terms indefinitely. So the way to take back the democracy is to beat these people. And the way to define the way to repair to the center is to define a new center by winning. And then you can combine policies and programs that can begin to restore respect for democratic norms, can restore the legitimacy of democracy itself, can restore the idea that activist government can actually help people, ordinary people, help the common good instead of being seen as a kind of toxic swamp that needs to be drained. And if everybody does it, well, you might as well, je m'en fous, you might as well vote for Trump. So I think the single most important thing that the Democratic Party can do is to win and to define, once again, in the spirit of Roosevelt, uses of government that serve ordinary people, and then we'll get our democracy back. I mean, in the age of Trump, in the age of Brexit, in the age of Orban, Erdogan, et cetera, I think it really misses what's going on to talk about technical fixes in the structure of voting systems.
So both of you have in mind quite ambitious programs to fix what's wrong. Could you talk a little bit about how you see those programs being realized, given our particularly difficult political moment? And I'm imagining, if I'm sitting in this room, I'm thinking, well, this is very interesting, but what can I do? Where should we start? So I'm not going to ask you what is the one thing that you think needs to happen in the next couple of years, but maybe two or three. What are the crucial changes? Who needs to do what to whom to really make progress in the direction you think is important? Bob, you want to go first?
Yes. I think one of the many mistakes that Hillary Clinton made in 2016 was that she was for a lot of little things. She was for dozens and dozens and dozens of smallish policy interventions. I think the next Democratic candidate needs to be for a few big things that people could feel would actually make a difference in their lives. For example, we have destroyed the promise of the next generation, at least those members of the next generation who don't have affluent parents who can give them a family welfare state to get them started, by saddling them with $1.3 trillion of student debt. We've never done anything like this to a generation in the past. And those are the kids who don't vote. They vote at reduced percentages compared to older people. So I was just interviewing a former member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. In the same way that they invented programs with the euphemism quantitative easing to buy bonds that were underwater, that were being held by financial institutions, You could buy securities that represent student debt, and you could simply hold a lot of that debt in the Fed's portfolio and write it off from the point of view of students. Now, a debt amnesty would get the attention of younger people. It might even help them get their lives back. That's one thing I'd do. Another thing I'd do is I would take the money that was in the tax cut and add a lot of money to it and have a multi-trillion dollar 10-year infrastructure and green transition program that would really make America great again and would put a lot of people back to work. If you take the train from Boston to New York or from Boston to Washington, you go through a museum of 19th century infrastructure. If you've ever been to Berlin, or for that matter, Beijing, you get the sense of what 21st century infrastructure looks like. We need World War II without the war. We need a World War II scale of public investment. If you did those two things, you might get your credibility back as a party that cares about the common people. The third thing I would do is I would re-regulate finance. After 1933, finance was turned into the servant of the real economy rather than the master. By the 90s, by the zeros, it became the master. We need to put finance back in its box so that ordinary people can understand it, so that financiers make ordinary incomes instead of astronomical incomes. I think if you did those three things, you would take away a lot of the bogus credibility that Crump enjoys of being the tribune of the common person.
Thank you. So, Bob, interesting enough, those are very structural suggestions. You told me, you suggested earlier that you didn't want us to get down the sort of narrow structural suggestions, and those actually ultimately are very structural.
Well, they're broad structural.
They're not very narrow.
Well, no, but they are structural. That was not what you were intimating.
They require
you were intimating
politics.
Something else.
They require
but
politics.
Everything, this is my fundamental point, everything requires politics. Maybe just to throw in my suggestions, I think, first of all, what I think this country needs is to really move away from the politicization. And I think you're great. I love your work, Bob. I really do. But I just wish you could say everything that you said without having to poke fingers at Trump and say, well, Hillary did this. I mean, I just think that we need to move away from the personalities and focus on the real issues plaguing this country today. No one is going to argue that infrastructure is dilapidated. The American civil engineers put out a report every couple of years. They've ranked the America's infrastructure as D+. We know this. We know that the pensions are in trouble. We know about the Congressional Budget Office forecast for debts and deficits. We know that the education system in this country is not delivering the kind of outcomes that we want. So rather than poke holes, it seems to me, at Trump or Hillary or whoever, I just think that belittles the argument. So from my vantage point, what I would recommend is, first of all, we really need more voter education. People really need to take the time to think about what these issues are and what the fundamental options at our disposal are. I think it's very easy for people to seduce voters because nobody seems to really understand what's going on, where the United States is in the cycle, and where these issues are more generally. So I would hope that we can take that out. Voters need to vote. Voting rates in this country are atrocious. It's 50% roughly. It's 30% for people at low income. I think there are things that we can do, and this is a very minute, but you know, minutia. But you know, there are things that we can do to get more people out there voting. It's not happening. I think that's really important. The other area, which is linked to the issue of going back to this point about sort of depoliticizing a lot of the issues that I feel we need to address, is I do think that the regulation, and I think most people, again, would not object to some forms of regulation in finance. We've had Dodd-Frank, we've had other regulations, Volcker Rule, etc. But I think even with technology, there will be more regulation there. And I think the fact that our young people are getting information that is inaccurate, it's not true, and it actually incites violence, it incites a negative tone in the country as opposed to one that encourages sort of communal working together, etc. I think that is an area where there's a lot of scope for improvement. So, I mean, this might be antithetical to the American view of laissez-faire in some quarters, but it seems to me that we need to stop being victims and play a much bigger role in the society that we've created.
So, Bob, I see you wanting to jump in, and I want to give you a chance to jump in. As you do so, could we bear in mind what's happening to our media environment, which neither of you have talked about? But we now understand much better the psychology behind the fragmentation and the hatred that's driving a lot of polarization. And it's interesting to me to hear you say, like, let's move beyond the polarization. A lot of young people would like to do that. But Bob, I can feel you thinking, no, that's not the right way to go. So say more.
Well, just a couple of comments. And I think it's very good that we're having this debate, and it is a debate. Regarding Trump, so I think almost everybody in this room would agree that Donald Trump is an aspiring dictator. And the only reason he has not succeeded in becoming a dictator is that the residual resilience of American democracy has prevented him from stealing what's left of our democracy. So this is not a matter of poking fingers. This is a matter of being deadly serious about getting him out of office the sooner the better.
But, Bob, you're now making a statement like that. You know, there may be people in this room who don't share that view. Well, and by making that statement, you are forcing them out of the debate.
No.
You know, I am not a Trump supporter, but I do not necessarily have data to say he wants to be a dictator.
You don't have data that Trump wants to be a dictator?
But I'm just saying, you can't make those types of claims with you make those type of claims. You're an important thought leader, you know, in this country and around the world.
Is it controversial
to make some of these statements? You know, you have said nothing to water down your argument. You could have said, you know what, the tax cuts did help in some respects, but they could be problematic. Infrastructure was good. You could make you could couch your criticisms in a particular way. But to sit in this room and say that, you know, you think he's on a path to be wanting to be a dictator and everyone in this room thinks, I just think that that's the type of language
we can take a poll, but this is
yeah, I can tell you I'm one person who does not think that.
Well, I don't know what universe you dwell in, but
Wait.
All right, let me finish.
Let's keep with the civic discourse. Yes.
Let me finish the point I was going to make. I think the way you win over Trump voters is to take seriously the economic grievances that caused people to vote for someone like Trump. And the way you do that is by taking the Democratic Party back from the fact that a good chunk of it has been captured by Wall Street. So I think in the next election, what the Democratic Party needs to do in order to win over 10 or 20% of Trump voters is to demonstrate that it is serious about helping to improve their lives. Now, you're right that there are a fraction of people who think that Trump is a great guy, and I am not going to win them over by soft-pedaling my criticisms of the way Trump is trying to destroy our democracy. I'm very sorry. That's not who I am, and I don't think that's what the reality is. I also think, and you touched on the fact that a lot of people don't vote. People need to be motivated to vote. They need to feel that their vote is going to make a difference. A lot of the people who voted for Trump felt that their vote would make a difference because they felt that he would make America great again. I don't think you motivate people to vote by calling for 6-year terms. I just don't think there is enough of a technocratic good government constituency for that sort of appeal to restore voting percentages. People voted for Franklin Roosevelt in large numbers because they felt he'd make a constructive difference in their lives. And I think that's the challenge of the next progressive candidate. So, no, you make a very good point. You don't peel people away from the Trump constituency by insulting Trump. You peel people away from the Trump constituency by persuading them that active government can improve their lives. And what's really interesting to me is that in a lot of these swing states, you have voters who will sometimes vote for the far right and sometimes vote for the progressive left. In Montana, there's a governor by the name of Steve Bullock, progressive Democrat, liberal, progressive populist. He won by 4 points at a time when Trump won by 23 points. So there were 27% of the electorate who voted one way for governor, one way for president. In Ohio, where Sherrod Brown is up for re-election, that's a state that sometimes elects conservative Republicans, sometimes a state that elects progressive Democrats. That says to me that public opinion is not quite as polarized as many people think. It's more malleable. And you asked about media. I think the hardening of the society into, red states and blue states, despite Barack Obama's best efforts, and the hardening of the media into separate spheres, and the Twitterization of everything, and the dumbing down of discourse, it is one of the deep, deep problems that we have. I don't know of an instant cure for that. I would like to see a president who could elevate discourse and not try to do discourse by tweets and have a serious conversation with the American public. That might actually help.
Demisa, we have a couple of minutes, and then I'd like to turn to Q&A. Would you like to
close? There are a few things. And hopefully the takeaway here is that we should not be ideological. We're in a world now where China, a country that has deprioritized democracy and has emphasized state capitalism, is essentially nearly on par in terms of GDP with a country that's democratic and the United States democratic and has an economic ethos of market capitalism. We're in, particularly as economists, we don't really know how to address income inequality. We've tried left-leaning interventions, we've tried right-leaning interventions. They haven't really worked. So I think we should not be so dogmatic about where the world goes from here. There have been a lot of catastrophic mistakes. Jack Ma from Alibaba always makes the point that Western countries did benefit from globalization. There were trillions of dollars that were made. But guess what? The money that was earned was not invested in education. It was not invested in the heartland of the United States in infrastructure. It was invested in wars. That is a responsibility that we have to take as a society. But even beyond that, and I think it's to the point about where next, because who knows what's going to happen at the midterms? Who knows what's going to happen in 2020? What are we going to say if actually Trump wins again? That is the sort of question that I think we should spend our time on, trying to understand why is it that people have been so frustrated. And my lens is through the economic lens, but the truth is it may be much more deep-seated. I mean, I spend a lot of time in Europe and in Britain in particular. The sentiment there is far less to do with economics in a pure sense. There are cultural issues, identity issues that people are fighting against. And one of the most interesting articles that I read recently by Gillian Tett is that actually if you look at the backlash post the 2016 elections, virtually every country that has had a massive shift towards a populist has elected a right-wing populist. We're not electing left-wing wingers in terms of this debate. So as people who may be interested in the left-leaning arguments, people who are objective, people who are on the right wing, we need to understand why it is, if it really is the case that things are as awful as they are, as I think they are, we need to be much more nuanced about trying to come up with solutions. And the reason I mentioned technology was to try and address the media point. I think the media does a great disservice. I've talked about it a little bit in my book. In other countries, and I know, again, this is probably very antithetical to the United States, but in other countries, they have a state media. BBC in Britain in the past has been pretty objective. It was designed to be objective. We need portals of places we can go and get information that is not tainted by people's opinions and views. And unfortunately, we cannot get a straight answer from our politicians, from thought leaders, because everyone who is pro-Hillary, there's somebody who's pro-Trump, and I think that there's not enough space to have a good, balanced discussion on these issues.
Fantastic. We have a few moments now for questions, if anyone would like to ask a question. We have mics set up in the center aisle. May I ask that if you decide you'd like to ask a question, that you give your name and that it be a question. So an actual question.
Yes, hello. I actually have two questions, but one of them is extremely brief. The brief one, Ms.
Sir, could I ask that you have a great line behind you and we just have a brief time, so if you could go just for the one question?
Very well. Mr. Kuttner, then, I'm Jay Searson. You lead by saying that capitalism is oil and water, and you justify that using the period from the 1920s to like the 1980s or something. Prior to that, there were several hundred years where the only really democratic countries in Europe were the capitalist countries, mostly England and the Netherlands, where when the state held economic power through the king and his feudal lords, So too did it concentrate all political power, whereas where economic power was more distributed, so too was political power. And I'm wondering if you feel that that period isn't representative and your period is, how do you reconcile that distinction? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's a very good question. If you look at English democracy prior to 1833, and really prior to Lloyd George, a very small percentage of people voted. And similarly with Dutch democracy. Also, Germany, which was not a democracy in the 19th century, certainly in the late 19th century, outperformed Britain. So I think I'm not certainly making a case for dictatorship. What I am saying is, and the full oil and water comment was that mixing capitalism and democracy is like combining oil and water, because under capitalism, wealth concentrates, and wealth translates into political power to make the rules. I want to see a brand of capitalism that is compatible with democracy, that has an egalitarian distribution of the benefits. It's a virtuous circle because it produces legitimacy for the system. And I think when capitalism runs amok, people turn to dictators. So I don't think the history of Europe really belies that.
Thank you. The mic in the middle.
So I apologize for getting here a bit late, so I didn't hear all of the beginning. But, you know, I'm with you on sort of getting beyond ideologies, because I find that they can hamper actual progress. And at the same time, we have a system where I'm one of those people who believes that Hillary probably won the Electoral College and that the Russians are spectacular at what they do in terms of hacking.
You're
so I'm wondering
to the question,
if you could
yeah.
address that aspect of things, that no matter how much you work and how much you are believing in the red state, blue state, at the end of the day, state players or non-state players can totally disrupt what we're calling a democracy, and yet I haven't felt for years that we've had a democracy. So if you could both address that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just a few things worth thinking about. You know, first of all, I think one of the crises of democracy is that we have a value system that the United States and many European countries do not abide by. So we claim that we believe in equality, and yet we are happy to trade with countries where women are not allowed to drive. Obviously, that situation has been remedied. You know, we have a situation, live situation, where a journalist has disappeared, and there's really no penalty. Nobody's even a penalty box, and there's been really no forceful comment, even from the United Nations. So we are in a world where I think that there's a lot of skepticism already about whether or not we really believe in these things, or they're just nice things to put on pieces of paper. But, you know, even beyond that, we've been talking a lot about democracy here and the historical context of democracy. The United States has been and many other countries as well, it's an experiment and a progression of trying to test the boundaries of democracy. It's not that long ago that blacks were not allowed to vote in this country. You know, there are many people who are in this room who were around when that was very much a legal part of the system. So let's not look back too far in history and think, wasn't it just so great in those times? There was not that long ago that women were not allowed to vote. So it's an evolutionary process, and I think that in terms of ideology, we need to look at these things in that context.
Well, I think democracy is being threatened by a number of different things, one of which is a domestic assault on the right to vote. You have voter suppression going on in a number of states. It's also the case that Russian bots and Russian trolls and Russian fake news sites have not been contained and are likely to play a role in the midterm election, the 2020 election. It's not just that blacks were denied the right to vote not all that long ago. Blacks are being denied the right to vote in several states right now through all kinds of voter purge techniques and gerrymandering techniques. And so on the aspect of how democracy is being threatened, one has to be ever vigilant. Now, on the question of whether we should be ideological or not, this has been a really interesting, illuminating debate. Of course, we have to be ideological because there's one ideology that says, let the market do its thing, don't regulate capitalism. And there's another ideology that says, if you want capitalism to operate in the broad public interest, if you want it not to lead to disaffection that in turn leads to despotism, you have to regulate capitalism. And there are good debates about how you do it and how much you do it. But that is irrevocably an ideological debate. And to say that, well, all the major issues are now technical, there's no ideological debate anymore, I just think is not correct, nor is it helpful.
Who said that?
I don't know.
Somebody say that? All right.
I think you said we should not be ideological.
I said we should not, because, and I gave explained why, but you're packaging it in a way that is not accurate, I'm afraid.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Okay. One more question at the front.
I like the idea that by putting forward legislation that would attract voters from across the spectrum, we could restore the democracy.
Can you get closer to the mic, sir?
I'm actually kind of afraid that we have a system that's set up and is inclined towards inaction and inefficiency with checks and balances as opposed to a parliamentary system. And with the breakdown in norms, it's increasingly difficult to get anything done. How could the Democrats promise this legislation, and how could they enact it without restoring norms first?
Yes, that's a terrific question. Now, don't forget, the framers of the Constitution created checks and balances, but they did not envisage a situation where a president who was not particularly respectful of democratic norms would have working majorities in both houses of Congress who would be willing to give him what he wanted. And so you get legislation like the tax bill enacted, and I think if you go back through history, you have had moments where progressive Democrats, Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson before Vietnam, also had working majorities in Congress and were able to get progressive legislation enacted. So if any of these programs are to be more than slogans, like a student debt refinancing and amnesty, the only way you're going to do it is by electing a president who believes in it, who has a working majority in Congress, and maybe even some of those programs are so popular, so hard to vote against, that you'd bring over a few people from the other party.
Do you want to speak to this question, Debbie?
No, I think that was
okay. In the middle.
Yes, I can imagine another panel discussion going on simultaneously with this one about the threat to democracy, but the focus of this conversation would be on the cultural identity, fear of other, tribalism. And this seminar is focused on the economic side.
Right.
How do each of you weigh which of those two is a better explainer of the rise of populism and the threat to democracy?
Great question.
Oh, I think that's a fantastic question. And I did intimate a few moments ago that if you go to other places, in for example, in Europe, the debate there, Brexit, for example, is much more about these social construct issues, more cultural issues, and less about the economics. It's very hard to weigh them because I think in many respects they are interrelated. I think groups that feel disadvantaged do not feel that they are participating in economic success. They've seen social mobility plummet over the past multiple decades. Those types of groups are, you could argue, are tend to be groups that may be leading the charge in terms of the need for populism. One of the things, books that was illuminating for me as a black person living in the United States was a book by a white guy who went to Yale, Hillbilly Elegy. I'm sure many people have come across that book. It was about a white guy, a lower income, from Appalachia originally, but I think those types of ideas suggest that there is a much bigger debate to be had. And perhaps being an economist, I only can offer one lens, but I think it's valid to say that there are other strands of theory that make sense as well. I don't know if you wanted.
Yeah, this is the single most important thing, and I'm so glad you asked the question, that we really have to understand. When you try to persuade ordinary working people to open their hearts to people who are different at a time when you're taking away their livelihoods, you're not going to get their votes. And to say to working class white people in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, we're going to ship your job overseas, and you're not doing as well as other people because you weren't smart enough to get enough education. And by the way, you're also going to have to be much more tolerant of African Americans, of immigrants, of gays, of lesbians, of transsexual people. And you have someone like Trump whacking away at political correctness and talking about Mexicans as rapists. Guess who they're going to vote for? And I think the counterpart in Europe is the fact that they liberalized their policy on immigration and refugees in the wake of the 2008 collapse. So I think the task of the next progressive president is to disentangle the cultural issues from the pocketbook issues and lead with the pocketbook issues. I'll tell you one anecdote. There's a guy in West Virginia who looks like a Trump voter. He's a Marine, he's a tough guy, and he's running as a kind of populist Democrat. And he went to a Planned Parenthood rally, and this is what he said. He said, "I hate abortion. I hate abortion. But I'll tell you one thing. If we criminalize abortion, rich women are still going to get abortions." So that's taking a divisive cultural issue and reframing it as a class issue. And I think a lot of issues that get articulated as identity politics issues, some of them at least, have an aspect that can be reframed as class issues. That's the task of political leadership, to put pocketbook issues back at the center of debate, to build coalitions so that everything doesn't get reduced to identity. Because when everything gets reduced to identity, Steve Bannon, my pal, wins. I mean, Bannon's strategy was to racialize everything. And the more it boils down to identity, the more the racializers win.
We have precisely 2 minutes left. So I'm going to make a, I'm going to make a logistical announcement, and then I'm going to ask you both, if you were going to leave this group with one idea, what would it be? Okay? So here's my logistical announcement. I hope that you're very excited about what our speakers have said and would like to come up and talk to them and so on, but we need to whisk them to the book signing table, both so that this room can be used for another panel and so that they can start signing books. So once we're done, we're going to take these guys and zoom them to the book signing panel. Okay? So, 1 minute, one idea. What do you want to leave this group with?
Well, two ideas. First idea is buy the book.
He means my book, second, by the way, not his.
Right. buy both. You can continue this debate in your own living room by buying both of our books.
There you go.
The one idea I'd like to leave you with is this. If you want to get democracy back, we have to get back to a kind of tamed, harnessed, housebroken capitalism that serves broad majorities of people. If we don't get that, we're going to continue to get a slide into economic nationalism. Karl Marx was wrong about a lot of things, but the thing that he was wrongest about for purposes of my book is that he thought when capitalism ran amok, workers of the world would unite. Turns out, when capitalism runs amok, workers of the world embrace ultranationalists. That's not good for democracy. It's not good for the project of managing capitalism in the public interest.
Well, my final point is an appeal as an immigrant to this country. This is the United States of America, where we are. And I really, really hope that people be energized that change is possible. The world is looking to the United States in many respects, not just in terms of politics and democracy, but also in terms of economic path. And all the issues that we've talked about here, whether it's hinting on redistribution or issues about education and infrastructure, are critically important for the survival of this country, but also for the survival of the world. We are relying on the United States to help come up with solutions for many of the challenges that we've outlined here. And unfortunately, I really worry that there's a loss of confidence in this country, and I think that there are people who are divisive dictators or people with very negative leanings who are creating a greater schism in this country. And I really hope that people can go back to basics and think about, you know, the greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw has written about, and the past of this country that really came from an idea and remains an idea that many people around the world aspire to.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking our speakers.